Hi. My name's Michael Manning Earl, and I'm a female alcoholic. And it's a pleasure to be here tonight. I'm glad I thawed out a little bit. I told my friend that I wish I hadn't taken my estrogen. I could use the hot flash. It was so... I mean, it was cold in here. My teeth were chattering. I didn't know how I was going to get through this talk, but they've warmed it up a little bit, and if that guy's an alcoholic, we all should be getting hot pretty soon because we go from one extreme to the other. It's a privilege to be invited. I'd like to say I was asked to do this at 6:35 2 years ago, so I've had 2 years to get it right. And one thing I really feel uncomfortable talking in Georgia just for one reason, because I feel like everybody has heard me so many times and it's the same story. I'm really thankful I have the same story. I haven't had to go out there and do any research, but it embarrasses me that you have to hear me so many times. But the one thing I do love about speaking in Georgia, every time I speak in Georgia, I'm the Friday night speaker. And I love that. I mean, I love to talk and get it over with, because I'm one that still gets very, very, very nervous, and I can go through the whole conference nervous, and I'm Sunday morning a lot, you know, and that makes for an uncomfortable few days. So I really love getting to be Friday night, and I've talked to lots of speakers, and that seems to be everybody's feeling. You know, that's their favorite place to talk, and to just get up here, get it over with, and be able to be part of the conference. And I'm excited. There's some speakers here that I have not heard their story before, so that makes it real special for me. And then I'm excited about the people here that I have heard their stories, and I just love them, and I feel a real bond with them. And you have some dynamite speakers this weekend. Pat, thank you for inviting me. And I want to thank the whole committee. The fruit basket was wonderful. The flower was wonderful. I feel treated very special, very special. And there's a lot of people here that I love a lot. People from my hometown area, where I live now, which is Augusta, and I feel like I've settled in and I'm, you know, a southerner now. I just have to get the accent down, you know, I just have to do something with my accent. That's the only thing. But other than that, I feel like I'm really settling in. But I'm really excited because Barbara and Michelle are here, and they live in the Atlanta area, and those are the first two real southern women that I met. The first conference that I spoke at in this area on the East Coast or in the South was near Stone Mountain or something, and Barbara and Michelle picked me up from the airport. I flew in from California, and it was my first Southern experience, and Michelle and I stayed in contact. She made several trips to California, or made a trip to California, and then I spoke up and down the East Coast, and whoever thought that I'd be living here, huh, Michelle? Whoever thought that several years ago when we all went out to breakfast? It's just amazing, you know, the changes that come about when you stay sober. Anyway, I am from California. I was raised in California. I'm going to try really hard. My husband pointed out to me the other day that I play with my bracelet when I'm up here, so I'm going to try not to play with my bracelet. So I might get real stiff up here. But I, as I said, I do get nervous. Anyway, I was raised in California. I was speaking in Edisto Beach, South Carolina, when I met my husband, and this man just totally swept me off my feet. And he was this big southern gentleman, and I want to introduce my husband, Ted. Would you please stand up? He hates this. I still love to look at him. He's just got the most beautiful smile. I just love this man. Anyway, he just swept me off my feet, and we only spent about 45 minutes together at this conference because his sponsor had died and he had to take care of a lot of funeral arrangements. But he asked if he could write me and call me, and of course I said yes, and so we wrote to each other and talked on the phone a lot. We had a relationship strictly by phone and by mail for a lot of months. And that's a wonderful way to get to know somebody. It truly is, because we did not have the complication of the physical to interfere with the romance. And when we finally did get together, the romance was definitely there. It was definitely there. But in July of 1995, we had the International, the AA International in California, San Diego, and Ted came down and we spent a week together. And then I made two trips up to Augusta to see him. And my second trip, he was waiting for me at the airport with a bouquet of flowers, and he proposed to me. And it was very romantic, and it's just like you read about in the fairy tale books where you're actually courted, you're proposed to, you're given an engagement ring. I'm almost 50, and he was almost 60, so it was a short engagement. Long engagement, not a good idea. It was a short engagement. And we got married. You know, it's just like you read about in the fairy tale books, and it never happened to me that way before. This is the first time, and I was almost 50 years old. And we got married on the beach in Edisto, where I met him, and it was a beautiful wedding. We had a lot of AA people there. Michelle was there. We had a rainbow came out in time for the wedding, and we had 6 dolphins out there in the ocean, and it was just very romantic. And I went back to California and packed up my stuff and moved to Georgia, and I wish I could say that we lived happily ever after, but it just wasn't the case. Something set in, something called reality, and it was very difficult. It was a culture shock for me. I'm a city girl, you know, I'm from the Los Angeles area, and it was a culture shock. That's all I can say is, you know, anything I know about a deer is Bambi, you know, and I moved to Georgia in October and everybody shoots Bambi. And I just think, you know, to me it looked like if it moved, they shot it, you know, that they were shooting everything. I even told that to my husband. I was, you know, I was very distraught about all this, and I said, well, at least in California, we don't shoot the animals. And he said, no, you just shoot each other. Okay, well, that's a good point. But the worst thing that happened to me at that time is I went into menopause. And all I can say is menopause, what an order. My husband just can't go through with it. I talk about menopause from the podium because it was very dramatic for me. And I believe that we need to talk about things that are current and things that are, you know, hard for us to deal with in sobriety. And I know it shocked some people. I was speaking in Cleveland, and I said the word menopause from the podium. And when you're up here at the podium, you can see everybody's reaction. I mean, if you're scratching, I can see. If you fall asleep, I can see. You know. And I've seen some stuff up here, believe me. No, anyway, so people in the denial section necking. I mean, it all goes on. But anyway, I said the word menopause from the podium, and the room just got quiet. It was just like they went, and this one lady bent over to another lady, and she said, did she say menopause? I mean, I can tell you I'm a prostitute and I'm a thief, and you applaud me and you cheer me and you love it. For God's sake, don't say menopause. But anyway, menopause was very dramatic for me because I did not know what was happening to me. Hot flashes and night sweats were the very least and the very last thing to happen to me. I guess I had started before I even moved to Georgia, and I was not aware of what was going on because I had developed a sleeping disorder, and I just attributed it to traveling so much, you know, because I was speaking a lot and I was traveling a lot, so I figured that's why I stopped sleeping. I'd go weeks without sleeping, and I developed severe migraine headaches and depression and panic attacks, and it was just awful. I thought I was having a nervous breakdown. I did not know what was happening to me, and you know, it was very hard being this visible in AA. Everyone on the East Coast had heard me talk, and I guess they think when you have that many years of sobriety and you travel all over speaking that you really got it together, you know, and that's just not the truth. Any of us, you talk to any speaker and they'll tell you we're just as crazy and we're just as vulnerable at 18 years as we are at 1 year. And I was in a very, very bad place, and I was just a drunk that needed another drunk. And I tried to reach out to women, and some of them just, I think they just didn't know what to do with me or didn't know what to say to me. That one of the women that I reached out to who helped me the most had 1 year of sobriety. You know, in the meetings I went to, there weren't any women with more sobriety. So I had to really humble myself and reach out to people with less sobriety. And one of the greatest gifts was a woman who had 1 year, and the gift that she gave me was time. you know, she had time for me and she spent time with me. And also she'd been through menopause and she helped guide me to the right doctors. I started all over on step one and I did another inventory and I gave it away and I just did every, all I ever knew what to do was start all over on step one when I was going through these things. But the one thing that I did do, and I think it's the healthiest thing that I did, is I went on the other side of town and I planted my fan in a newcomers meeting. You know, the big book on page 14 and 15, right in the beginning of the book, it says, you know, for if an alcoholic fails to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he cannot survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. So this sentence tells me two things. First of all, it tells me that I don't even grow spiritually unless I'm working with others. And then it tells me that I'm not going to survive those certain trials and low spots ahead unless I'm working with others. So I would go to the other side of town, I'd plant my fanny into a newcomer's meeting, and for an hour I did not think about myself. I would think about those newcomers, and I'd stick out my hand, and I finally started sponsoring in Georgia. And one of the greatest gifts that God sent me was a fabulous woman named Vivian. And I just love Vivian so much. And Vivian thought she really needed me, but the truth is I really needed Vivian. And I was able to take Vivian through her steps, and a lot of things were revealed. You know, Vivian had been sober for a little while, but she'd never really completed her steps, really never did a thorough fourth. For one thing, she was on that marijuana maintenance program, and it was just, you know, it's real hard to do a fourth step, you know, when you're doing that marijuana maintenance. She kids around and she talks about having to go smoke before she started her fourth step, and then she'd just say, oh, what the heck, you know, and she never got to her fourth step. So anyway, but she had a few years of sobriety, and what was revealed in her inventory is that, and she'd never talked about it in a meeting, never talked about it to anybody, was that her 9-year-old daughter died in a car accident with her as a result of her alcoholism. And we listed her at the top of her list on her step 8. And I told her what I was told, that you don't have to go through anything alone in Alcoholics Anonymous. She needed to make amends to her daughter and that I would go to the grave with her. She had never even seen her daughter's grave. And she had been in the hospital herself for over a year after her daughter died. And then she drank for another 14 years over the death of her daughter. I mean, we know she drank because she's an alcoholic, but she used the death of her daughter to continue drinking. So she'd never even seen her daughter's grave. So we went to, I had her write her daughter a letter, and it was a very beautiful letter. And in this letter, she invited her daughter's spirit to stay with her and help her to help other mothers recover so that more children do not have to die of this disease. And anyway, we went to this grave. It was in Columbia, South Carolina. We had a hard time finding the plaque. It was 105 degrees out there, and it was just a little teeny plaque in this big, huge cemetery. We finally found the plaque, and we took the letter and her chip. We were going to bury her chip to the gravesite. And right as she started reading this letter, a cool breeze came, and it was very cool. The temperature must have dropped from 105 into the 80s. It was a very cool breeze, and my hair was blowing back, and Vivian's hair was blowing back, and she read this beautiful letter to her daughter. And then we dug a hole, and she dropped her chip into the hole, and we buried it. And then as soon as we finished burying her chip, the breeze stopped. It just totally stopped, and it was 105 degrees again. And at that point, out of nowhere, because this was just in a, there was grass around, but there were no trees, no bushes, nothing around this little plaque. Out of nowhere came this ladybug, and this little ladybug flew right past me onto Vivian's arm, and it just proceeded to crawl up and down Vivian's arm. And Vivian was just kind of mesmerized by this ladybug, and she finally sat down at the grave, and I went back to the car to allow her with Tina's memory. The little girl's name was Tina. Anyway, this ladybug crawled up and down Vivian's arm, up and down her leg. Vivian sat out there for about 20 minutes with her, with the ladybug. And I didn't know what was going on. I was kind of worried about Vivian, but I knew I was sharing a spiritual experience with her. And when she came to the car, she shared with me that she couldn't leave as long as that ladybug was on her, because ladybugs were her daughter's very favorite thing. And so we don't believe that the spirit was in the ladybug or anything like that. We just believe that that was just, you know, just a sign from God that everything was okay. And today, Vivian and I both wear ladybugs. When I buy one for me, I buy one for her. When she buys one for her, she buys one for me. We both wear ladybugs. We wear them in the memory of Tina because we want to keep Tina's memory alive. She had stuffed that for a lot of years and pretended she didn't exist. And we don't want that little girl to have died in vain because this is a very serious disease. It's a family disease, and it affects everybody close to the alcoholic. Anyway, when I crawled through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous over 18 years ago, I had a formal ninth grade education. I didn't know how to work. I lived on welfare. I was reduced to prostitution, and I was a thief. And all of that was before I took that first drink at the age of 25. And when I finally broke down and took that drink, I immediately went downhill. So as you can see, there's nothing in my background that's prepared me for speaking except for the fact that I am an alcoholic and I try to speak from the heart. And I've always heard that Alcoholics Anonymous is the language of the heart, where the heart speaks and the heart listens. And I really want to welcome the newcomers. Are there any newcomers here with less than 30 days? How about anybody with less than 6 months? Welcome. Welcome. I like newcomers to know that the absolute highest you get in Alcoholics Anonymous is sober. It is not a speaker. And I'm not an authority on AA. I'm just up here sharing my personal experience, strength, and hope. And the things I say from the podium are the things that had a profound effect on my personal sobriety. I like to welcome those of you who are not so new but are having difficulty with this program. I saw a sign in an AA club that always gave me a lot of hope. And that sign says that you're not a failure unless you quit trying. And I believe that's true. So please, whatever you do, just keep coming back. But I was told early on in this program that this program is not for spectators. This is a program of action, and those actions are the 12 steps as laid out in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, Dr. Bob, one of our co-founders, said if you boil those 12 steps into two words, those two words would be love and service. And before he said that, he said, I want to emphasize the simplicity of this program. Let's not louse it up with Freudian complexes that are interesting to the scientific mind but have little to do with our actual AA work. And I see a lot of things drifting in and out of AA today. They might not be Freudian, but they're just as useless. And what they do is they just complicate this very simple program. Now, in the big book, under doctor's opinion, it tells me that many types of alcoholics do not respond to the ordinary psychological approach. So I'm here today or tonight to tell you that I'm one of those alcoholics. In fact, so is my mom. We both tried to recover from this disease through the psychiatric effort. Different times, but we went to the same psychiatrist. Of course, the result was nil. But the good news is that today, that very same psychiatrist is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, my mom and I both tried to recover from this disease through the religious effort, different times in different congregations, and the result was the same. Believe it or not, today, that very same minister that counseled me is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I like to joke around and say I think we drove these two men to drink, but the truth is, and this is the truth, my mom slept with the psychiatrist and I slept with the minister. And that's why I'm usually invited to be the Sunday morning spiritual speaker. But one thing I know for sure is that psychiatrist, that minister, and myself are perfect examples that AA works when other things fail. A little bit about my background. First of all, I'm Irish, German, and Cherokee, and I'm illegitimate. And being born out of wedlock today is just not a big deal. But when I was a little girl growing up, it was. And my childhood is pretty appalling. So in my mom's defense, I want to tell you a little bit about her childhood. Because as bad as mine was, my mom's was worse. And this program gave me the ability to have a very loving relationship with my mom, even though she couldn't quit drinking. And I lost my mom 5 years ago. She died of lung cancer. I had the opportunity to practice love and service at home. My sister and I took my mom home. We had hospice come in, and my mom got to die with a little bit of dignity. And I had the ability to get in bed with my mom, hold her all night, and just love her unconditionally. And I had to watch this woman drink on top of morphine up until the day she could no longer swallow. And it's probably one of the hardest things that I've ever done. But one thing I learned from this whole experience is that my whole life growing up, I was so focused on the things I hated about my mom, the things I didn't want to be like, that I missed all of her wonderful qualities. My mom had a lot of wonderful qualities, and I really miss her a lot today. But my mom came from an alcoholic background, and when she was 13, her mother was murdered in a drunken brawl. A drunk slit my grandmother's throat. So that left my mom out on the streets at the age of 13 trying to raise herself. At the age of 14, she had her first baby, which she gave up for adoption. And then she had me, and she did everything in her power to keep me. She later met this man, got married, had three boys. We all moved to California. That marriage soon ended in divorce, and my stepdad moved back to Colorado. So that left my mom out in California trying to raise four little kids. And we were raised on welfare. We were raised in extreme, extreme poverty. Always having lights, gas, telephones turned off, always being evicted, even sleeping in cars. And then I had to deal with my mom's alcoholism, I had to deal with her prostitution, and I had to deal with her suicide attempts. When I was 12, my mom got pregnant again. And this time she sent my three younger brothers to live with their real dad in Colorado. Now, my three brothers were my very best friends. When you're sleeping in cars and you're being evicted, you don't have an opportunity to make friends. So my brothers were my friends. So I feel like at the age of 12, I already had all these feelings that I later brought with me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And those feelings were of low self-worth, low self-esteem, not equal to, and just not good enough. And that was a direct result of all that poverty. The drunken psychiatrist pointed out to me that I had issues of abandonment. You know, I never knew my real dad. My stepdad went away. My three brothers went away. My mom's always trying to kill herself. And because of some other childhood experiences, I would say I'm a fear-based person. I have always been afraid of people, places, and things. And the two very important things I learned when I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is, first of all, I learned that feelings are not facts. All those things I used to think about myself were not the truth, and best of all, I learned how to walk through fear. And I learned that every time I walk through fear, I'm actually exercising faith. And this last 5, 6, 7 years, I lose count now, I've walked through one of my biggest fears, and it's getting on airplanes. It took me 12 and a half years of sobriety to finally get on an airplane, and I found out that I'm not even afraid of flying. I'm afraid of crashing. My sponsor told me I had better be clear on what my fear was when I was asking God to remove it. But I hear a lot of things in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous that are not necessarily in the big book, and sometimes they can confuse a newcomer. And the one thing I used to always hear when I first got here is that you could not have fear and faith at the same time. That you could not have fear and faith at the same time. And I had really worked my steps, and I've had spiritual experiences, but I still had a lot of fear, and I couldn't figure out what I was doing wrong in my program. I used to ask people all the time, what's wrong with me? What am I doing wrong? And I'd have people say things like, well, it sounds like you haven't taken a thorough third step. Well, today I know that the third step is only a decision. That's all it is. It's a decision. And the way we follow up on that decision is take the actions of 4 through 9. But finally, I asked the right person. I asked an old-timer. And the old-timer took me to the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, Michael, nowhere in the big book does it tell you you cannot have fear and faith at the same time. And he took me to page 68 in the big book under the fear inventory. And he said, this is what it says about fear. It says, all men of faith have courage. All men of faith have courage. And then this old-timer pointed out to me that you don't need courage unless you're afraid. And then he took me to that little fear prayer where it says, God, remove my fear and direct my attention to what you would have me be. And I say that prayer a lot, and usually I'm directed to help another person, whether they're in the program or out of the program, and it gets me through these situations every time. And I guess a lot of alcoholics spend a lot of time dealing with fear, because in 10 and 11 in the big book it tells us to continue watching for fear. And then there's this on step 11, it says if you find that you're in fear, there might be some corrective measures that you might need to take. And I have found working with a sponsor, I've had to take corrective measures and walking through my fears. Anyway, so when I was 13, my mom did have this baby. And I had to learn how to be a mom. And I didn't even know how to be a kid. My mom's alcoholism took her out of the home. She was never, ever around, and I had full responsibility of this little baby. And this little baby is sleeping in a dresser drawer, and I eventually had to potty train her, bottle break her. I'm failing in school because I can't get to school because of this responsibility. Now, after doing my inventory, I found out the truth was I hated school anyway. When I went to school, I was either an object of pity around my peers, or I was teased about the way I dressed and teased about my hair. And so specifically to get out of my home life, at the age of 15, I got married. And the man I married lived in the neighborhood. He came from a similar background. I have such a colorful past that I like to brag about this. I want everyone here to know when I got married at the age of 15, I was not pregnant. At the age of 15, I had high morals and high values. I really did. I had these two TV shows I used to watch. They were my favorite programs. Most of you are too young to remember these shows, but it was Donna Reed and Father Knows Best. And these were family programs, and because of these shows, I had these high morals and high values. My whole life growing up, all I knew is when I grew up, I didn't want to be an alcoholic like my mom, and I didn't want to prostitute like my mom. So when I got married at the age of 15, I had this wild idea that I was Miss Donna Reed marrying Mr. Father Knows Best, and unfortunately it didn't turn out that way, and I believe the man I married was an alcoholic. One indication, his name was Johnny Walker. I didn't have a clue back then. But I want to share a story with you about that sister of mine, the one that slept in the dresser drawer. Because when I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I used to blame my alcoholism on my mom's alcoholism. And I blamed the way I turned out on the way I was raised. And after I got sober in this program, I took a good look at that sister of mine because she came from the very same background. In fact, I would say her childhood was worse than mine, because my mom's disease had progressed. And my sister was literally forced to move out of the house at the age of 16. So she quit school and she moved out. But what she did is she took that high school equivalency test, and she had to take it 3 times until she finally passed it. With this test under her belt, under a special youth program, she went to work for the city of Long Beach. At the age of 26, she retired from the city of Long Beach. She took her 10 years retirement pay. She bought her own business. She later married the head traffic engineer for the city of Long Beach. And 6 years ago, at the age of 30, my sister was awarded Woman Entrepreneur of the Year. Now, even today, sometimes I still don't get it. Yes. Same mom, same background, but different reactions. And the difference is my sister is not an alcoholic. My sister is not bodily and mentally different from her fellows. My sister reacts to life situations differently than I do. So today I get to accept responsibility, and I can no longer blame people, places, and things. I am an alcoholic, and I do have a disease, but today I have a solution. And for me, part of my solution is being accountable for my actions, my past actions, and my present actions. So at the age of 15, I got married. At the age of 17, I did have a baby. At the age of 18, I had to get out of this marriage because this man took me through a whole new phase of alcoholism I never experienced with my mom, and it's called physical abuse. And he never abused me unless he was drinking, but he abused me to the point of cutting me up with a knife, and I had to have surgery to repair the damage. So I got out of that marriage at the age of 18. And I feel like that's when I started on the road of being everything I swore I'd never be, doing everything I swore I'd never do. Hadn't even taken a drink of alcohol yet. I always intuitively knew if I took a drink, I'd be an alcoholic. But it started out with me being a single mother living on welfare. My whole life growing up like that, I swore when I grew up I wouldn't live like that, and there I was. Now, on page 23 in the big book, it says the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. So we're talking about the main problem being the mental obsession and not the physical allergy. So I know for me, I practiced my disease of alcoholism way before I ever took that first drink, because I have always had the mental obsession part of this disease. And I practiced it in the form of compulsive overeating. I would shove food in my mouth instead of alcohol. And then I discovered that wonderful world of diet pills. And that's back in the days when doctors gave really good amphetamines. Methadrine, dexedrine, it's illegal now. So I went on a diet for 16 years. When I finally took that drink at the age of 25, I immediately had the physical allergy. From that very first drink, I had the phenomenon of craving. From that very first drink, I had a personality change, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. You read about that in the Big Book. The Big Book refers to that as a real alcoholic. And I personally am so physically allergic to alcohol that when I consume alcohol, I break out in a rash, welts and hives all over my body. And I was always too drunk to have a clue that that wasn't normal. And if I had a clue, it wouldn't have made a difference. But from that very first drink I drank morning, noon, and night, I did not draw a sober breath from the age of 25 to the age of 31. And that is not an exaggeration. I had this huge spiritual experience way before I ever got to this program. And this was equivalent to the one that Bill had in Bill's story. Now, in the Big Book, it says, as a result of a spiritual awakening, you'll have a change in psyche, a change in attitude. It says you'll have a huge emotional displacement and rearrangement. And this spiritual experience I had was not enough for me to achieve that. And I believe it's because I did not have a plan of action to go with it. But it was enough for me to come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. So what I did with this experience is I went to this church, I counseled with this minister, I told him all about my spiritual experience, I shared with him all my character defects and all my shortcomings. And this man assured me if I got really active in this church and I read all these inspirational books, and I did all this positive thinking and all these affirmations, that I could be everything that I ever wanted to be. After I got to this program, I heard a speaker say, if you're an alcoholic, you cannot think your way into right actions. He said, if you're alcoholic, you have to act your way into right thinking. And I'm absolute proof of that because I got really active in that church. I even became secretary of that church, and I struggled reading those books because I could barely read. I did all that positive thinking, constant affirmations, and the only thing that resulted is I ended up having a torrid affair with this minister. And it absolutely infuriated his wife. And the rest of the congregation wasn't too excited about it either. But the one thing I'm going to share with you now is the one thing I thought I'd take to the grave with me. As secretary of that church, it was my job to handle the money. And when I handled that money, I stole part of that money. Now, at that point in my life, I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt my only hope was God. Because I just had a spiritual experience. And I turned to God for help. And I ended up seducing his minister and ripping off his church. So I truly know that feeling of hopelessness that they talk about in the Big Book. I'm going to share two stories with you while I'm on the subject of the minister. And I like to share this first story because it's the first time I was ever able to laugh at any part of my alcoholism. When I got to this program, I heard that laughter was healing. But I always thought my story was just much too serious. And when I got here, I used to hang out at the very back of the room. And I have a friend named Teddy. And Teddy calls the back of the room the half-measure section or the denial section. I love to look back there because they wave at me. And they Now, I didn't hang out back there for either of those reasons. I hung out back there because I couldn't read very well. And I was terrified that they would ask me to read something. And I literally could not say the word anonymity for over 6 months. So I would always hide out at the back of the room, and speakers would get up here, especially in California, we have some very funny speakers. They would get up here and they'd share their stuff, and everybody would laugh. At first, I was absolutely incapable of laughing. But one day, after I had some sobriety under my belt, I caught myself in the back of the room laughing too. And right after having this big belly laugh, I found myself thinking, well, that might be funny for you, but there is nothing. Absolutely nothing in my background that I could ever laugh at. And about 6 or 7 years ago, I was speaking in Seal Beach, California, and it was just my second time to ever give an AA talk. I never talked or shared my story till I was 11 years sober. And my daughter wanted to come hear me. Now, my daughter got to this program for the first time when she was 15 years old, and she did get 3 years of sobriety, and because of a tragedy, she lost her sobriety. Today she's 32 and she has 5 years of Big Book solid sobriety, and I'm very, very proud of her. In fact, she's just moved to Georgia and we're in a business venture together, and that's very scary. But anyway, this is a period of time, isn't it, honey? This is a period of time where we were, where she was trying desperately to get sober again, and she heard I was talking, so she really wanted to come hear me. And before the meeting, she brought some of her program girlfriends over to my house. We sat down and we had coffee. Then my daughter proceeded to tell all of her girlfriends my drunkalog. And it was just the first time I was ever able to laugh at anything. For some reason, it was a little funnier coming out of her mouth than out of my head. And of course she's telling these girls all about the minister. And I just never thought about how some of this stuff looked through the eyes of a little 9-year-old, because she's 9 years old when I'm seeing this minister. And so she's telling these girls that I am dragging her off to church every day. She's learning things like the Ten Commandments, the Golden Rule. I'm constantly preaching religious stuff to her. She comes home from school at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. She opens the bedroom door, and there, naked in bed with her mom, was the married minister of the church. Now, when she first said this, I just felt all this shame, all this guilt and embarrassment, and I just looked at my daughter, and I said, God, honey, that had to be a terrible shock. And she just looked at me, and she said, no, Mom, I don't know what shocked me the most, seeing that minister naked or seeing his artificial leg on the floor. Up until that time, I forgot he had this artificial leg. It was a huge leg. I don't know how I forgot it. But trust me, this man in no way was disabled. After I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and I started working those 12 steps, I found for me the most important step was step 9. Now, step 9 is the amends step, the step where we make restitution. And I recommend you to do the first 8 steps before you get to step 9. I know some people come into this program, they take a look at step 9, it's so scary, they turn around and they leave. Other people come in and start right in on step 9 and make inappropriate amends. I believe the steps are in order for a reason, and I believe this one in particular should be taken with the advice of a sponsor. But I call step 9 the freedom step. This is the step that truly freed me from the bondage of my past. And it's just not a coincidence that in the big book, the promises come after step 9. And it says before you're halfway through, you're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. It says you won't regret the past or wish to shut the door on it, and so on and so on. And I did not have to wait to get halfway through step 9. That happened to me with my very first amends, and that was going back to that church and telling that minister I used to steal from the church funds, and he told me he knew that. And I set up a payment schedule to pay back the church. Then I had to tell him that I used to steal out of his wallet when he was in the shower. He told me he did not know that. So I made restitution to him. But the neat thing about this whole experience is he shared with me at that time he knew exactly what I was doing. By the time I got to him, he had 2 years of sobriety in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. When he lost his leg in that motorcycle accident, he was an alcoholic and a drug addict, and he actually died on the operating table. He had one of those near-death experiences, which for him was his spiritual experience. And that's what led him into ministerial schooling, becoming a minister. And even he could not get sober in church. And I'm not putting down churches, and I'm not putting down the psychiatric effort, because the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous makes it real clear that this program owes a lot to both of these institutions. And in the big book, it says if you need professional help, do not hesitate to seek it. But I got to tell you, for me, it was all about that miracle that happens when one drunk reaches out to another drunk. So I've been kicked out of this church. I'm 27 years old. I'm full on into my drinking. I'm living in an apartment I'm being evicted from. This is my normal MO. I'm always being evicted. Lights and gas had been turned off for a long time, but I still had a telephone. I got this call at 11 o'clock at night, and I could not believe the man on the other end of this phone. It was my real dad. Now, I barely knew this man's name was on my birth certificate. And he wanted to make amends for not being in my life. He wanted to get to know me, and he wanted to get to know my daughter. So he offered me an opportunity to move to Colorado to get to know his whole family. And I didn't want to go. I didn't have any desire to get to know him, but mostly I didn't want to move to the snow. But at that point in my life, I didn't have anywhere to go except for out on the streets. And deep down inside, I had this little hope if I did this geographic, maybe I could change. So I made that move to Colorado, and I lived there for 3 months. And in that 3-month period, this man and his family could not wait to kick me out of the state of Colorado. In that 3-month period, I ended up having affairs with bus drivers on the way over there, getting pregnant, having an abortion, falling down the stairs and breaking my leg, ripping off his medicine cabinet, ripping off his booze cabinet, and ripping off his money. So they literally kicked me out of the state of Colorado. I'm going to tell you how I broke that leg. Obviously, I was drunk. And in the neighborhood where I lived, the liquor stores closed at 12, and I had to make my final liquor run before the stores closed. And I lived in a second-floor apartment. It's snowing outside. The stairs are very icy. I'm walking down the stairs hanging onto the railing with my right hand. My daughter's on the left side of me trying to hold me up. And all of a sudden, out of another second floor apartment, I looked up because this door just opened, and out of that apartment walked a priest. I don't know what he was doing there, but he had the collar, the robe, everything. He was definitely a man of God. And I am very angry at God. I'm angry at God because I just seduced his minister, ripped off his church. So now I'm mad at God. And I looked up at that priest. I let go of the railing with my right hand. I flipped up my middle finger and I said, F you, God. And I immediately fell down the stairs and broke my leg. Now, my daughter tells me that is the day she started believing in a punishing God. And today we both know I fell because I was drunk. But anyway, my real dad was second on my list of amends to make when I started making my amends. And I wrote this man a letter, and I told him that I was sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I wanted to make restitution for my behavior up there. And I sent him a check, trying to set up a payment schedule to pay him back. And basically what he and the family did is they sent me the check back with a little note that said they didn't want my money and they never wanted to hear from me again. I was working with a sponsor, so of course I stayed sober, but I really did want to make these amends. So on every Father's Day and on every birthday, I would send him a card. And I would tell him that I was still sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and I still wanted to make restitution for my behavior up there. And he would never, ever acknowledge me. And I did this for years and years. And finally, in 1985 or 1986, I got a reply back. And I cannot tell you how excited I was when I saw the return address on that envelope. And I ripped open the envelope, and the only thing that was in it was a picture of his tombstone and the obituary out of the newspaper. He had just died. And that was the family's way of telling me not to bother trying anymore. And there are no words to express the kind of pain I felt. You would have thought I knew him my whole life, and I didn't, but I took it real, real hard. And the people in Alcoholics Anonymous pointed out to me I don't make amends for approval. The Big Book tells me I don't make amends to be forgiven. I make amends to clean up my side of the street. I make amends to stay sober. So all I can tell you is that the actions I took worked, because not once, not even once was I ever tempted to drink over that rejection. I'm just so sorry he didn't get to know the person I am today, because I know he would have been proud. So I've been kicked out of this church, and now I'm kicked out of a state. I'm living back in Long Beach, California, across the street from Franklin Junior High. Franklin Junior High is a middle school, and it's a gang-related school. And my daughter is now 14 years old, and she's running with a very dangerous gang. And I am doing awful, humiliating, embarrassing things to my daughter. But I'm not only embarrassing my daughter, I'm embarrassing this entire gang. I was living... This is really true, too. I was living in another apartment I was being evicted from. Lights, gas, and telephone had all been turned off for a long time. I'm hiding out from the landlord, so I kept my drapes closed, and my apartment is always dark. But my apartment is so dark that now I'm seeing evil spirits. And unless you've seen them, they're hard to describe. But these evil spirits would do things to me, like follow me around the house, and then I in turn would do things like crawl out of the house on my hands and knees, butt naked, across the street to the school ground, warn my daughter and her gang friends not to come home because the house is possessed with evil spirits. And this is the kind of stuff I did that makes me wish to God I was a blackout drinker. But I'm not. I get to remember it all. My neighbors felt sorry for my daughter. They would hide her out. Sometimes they would feed her. Sometimes they would even feed me. Once we were both next door at the neighbor's house, she was feeding both of us, and on her counter she had a bottle of 100-proof vodka. Something happened outside, a car accident or something. My neighbor and my daughter went to check it out, and I just kind of lagged behind because I wanted to drink some of that vodka down real fast and not get caught. So I just grabbed the bottle. I started drinking right out of the bottle, and I don't know how much I drank or how fast I drank it. But I do know it was in the respiratory system. At that point, I stopped breathing. And I can remember the sensation I couldn't breathe, and that's the last thing I remember. I don't remember the paramedics. I don't remember being rushed to the hospital. I don't remember being resuscitated. By the time I had any memory, I woke up strapped down to a hospital bed with a nurse slapping me in the face because I was screaming obscenities at her because I was a very mean and vile drunk. But this experience did get my attention. This time, I had almost died under the influence of alcohol, and it scared me. I did not want to die out there. So I finally started listening to my daughter, because my daughter used to tell me on a daily basis, she would say, "Mom, it's the alcohol. And if you wouldn't drink, you wouldn't do those things." She said, "Just smoke pot." So this is my only experience smoking pot, but I was trying really hard not to drink that day. And I don't have any friends of my own, so I smoked this pot with my daughter and her friends. And afterwards, we're walking down the street, and I have on these tight jeans, and I have both my hands in my pockets. And I tripped. I don't know if I tripped over my own foot or tripped over a crack, but I tripped, and I just started to go down. Now, I don't know if any of you have ever been on pot, but for me, it was different. First of all, I had the feeling that I was in slow motion. I had the sensation that the cement was coming up at my face, and no matter what I did, and I tried really hard, I could not get my hands out of my pockets. So you've got to picture a grown woman laying with her face smashed with cement, and both of her hands are still in her pockets. And everybody standing around me was laughing hysterically. They were absolutely hysterical. And I really hurt myself. And I'm laying there in a lot of pain, and I can hear everybody laughing. And as I heard that laughter, I had that moment of clarity. Right then and there, I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that pot was not the answer. And I went right back to my drinking, and I drank at the same pace for a while longer, but I don't know what finally happened. I finally reached a point you hear about in this program where I was just sick and tired of being sick and tired. In fact, you can read about it on page 151 in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it talks about the hideous four horsemen. That feeling, I woke up on my front room floor feeling that those feelings of terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. And I woke up in a puddle of fluid. I don't know what the fluid was. I took the first three steps. I didn't even know what the first three steps were. But I knew that I was powerless over alcohol and that my life had never, ever been manageable. And I already believed that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I just didn't know if he would because of what I had done to the church. And this was my way of turning my will and my life over to the care of God, as I just got on my knees and I said, "God, please, I don't care how you do it, but please just get me sober." And I managed to get to a telephone. I called a prayer line that was affiliated with the church I was in. And I asked them to pray for me, because in my mind I thought, if God wouldn't listen to my prayers because of what I'd done to the church, maybe he would listen to their prayers. And they prayed for me for 30 days, and within 30 days, I was sober. And it's a series of God coincidences that landed me in my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I would never have come to AA. I hated Alcoholics Anonymous. My mom was in and out of AA for years, and I knew this program didn't work. Today I know my mom did not work the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. She'd do the AA two-step, the first step, the 12th step. No steps in between. And if you talked to my mom about getting a sponsor, she would challenge you. She would say, "Where in the Big Book does it tell you to get a sponsor?" I don't know where she got that. She never read the Big Book, but she must have heard someone say it. So she never did get that much sobriety. But a series of God coincidences landed me in my first meeting. And I was so physically sick from withdrawals, there's no way I would have made that first meeting without a drink. And I ended up having two beers before the meeting, the last drink I ever had, and that was on November 10th, 1979. I don't celebrate my birthday till 3 months later because, let me tell you first a little bit about the old-timers in Long Beach. The old-timers latched on to me, and they're the ones that got me sober. I had a female sponsor, but these old-timers that latched on to me were men. And they were the father images that I never had. And there was absolutely no worry about the 13th step. Does anybody here not know what the 13th step is? Got lots of experience in this room, right? anyway, there's no worry about the 13th step, because you should have seen me. First of all, I was huge. I was very obese. I had all this wild bleach blonde hair. I don't know if any of you have been drunk and tried to bleach your hair, but you do this thing called overlapping, and plus you forget it's on there, so it stays on for 2 hours, so it causes your hair to break off. And then the last couple of months I was too drunk to bleach it at all, so I had these big black roots, different lengths of broken off bleach blonde hair, and it went every which way. Today that might be in style, but back then it wasn't. And my front teeth were worn up to here, so it looked like I had no front teeth. I was always profusely sweating. I wore this big serape to cover my body. I thought you wouldn't see me. And I was kind of alcoholic who didn't bathe. So there was no worry about the 13th step. These guys just desperately wanted me to get sober. And they gave me a coffee commitment within my first 2 weeks of sobriety. And they drugged me off to hospitals, sanitariums, and jails. I did not have enough time to be going on those panels, but I think they knew they'd lose me if they didn't get me active. And I'm very, very thankful for these men. But we had this one old-timer, and if you mentioned the word drugs, he would jump up, cuss you out, tell you to go to NA, and then he would stomp out of the room. So I learned early on in my sobriety at that very first meeting that I had better keep my mouth shut about those diet pills. But what that did for me is that allowed me to take diet pills for 3 more months. But when I quit drinking, I started working my steps, and God revealed to me right away I was not sober if I was abusing these pills. So I gave those up January 23rd, 1980, and that's when I celebrate my sobriety. Anyway, so I go into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have 2 beers in my system. So now I have a little bit of a personality change going on. Not a big one, just a little bit. I admit I'm an alcoholic, but I'm not an alcoholic like you guys, because you guys are alcoholics like my mom. It's the disease of perception, but I was buying it. And the first person shared that he'd been a blackout drinker. I looked at my 14-year-old daughter and I said, I have never had a blackout. The next person shared that he'd been to jail, and I looked at my daughter and I said, and I have never been to jail. The truth is, I was a home drinker. I was always too drunk to get out of my house to get arrested, and when I managed to crawl out on my hands and knees, one of the gang members would capture me and put me to bed. The third person shared that he had 5 502s. Now, back in California, a 502 was a drunk driving, and you just had to see me. My arms were crossed like this, and I was so defiant, and I said, that does it. I have never, ever had a drunk driving. And this time, my daughter looked at me with all the hate, all the contempt a pre-Al-Anon could have in her eyes, and word for word, she said, Mom, you don't even have a car. But when she said that, something clicked for me. At that point, I knew I was just sitting there looking for the differences. So if any of you are new or nearly new, I hope that you're not trying to judge your alcoholism by my actions. And I know that I have a story that's hard to identify with, but maybe you can identify with the feelings. Maybe you've had those feelings of low self-worth, low self-esteem, not equal to, and just not good enough. Maybe you've had those feelings of overwhelming fear, and this is the kind of fear that paralyzes you. It keeps you from going back to school. It keeps you from getting a better job. It did that for me, but it also kept me from getting on elevators, couldn't drive over bridges, couldn't get on airplanes or drive on freeways. I literally could not leave the city of Long Beach. It made my world real, real small. I used to have severe panic attacks behind my fear and sobriety. Or maybe you're like the alcoholic they talk about in the big book, grandiose and better than. To me, it's all the same for an alcoholic. It's just that my ego was in reverse. There is nothing more self-centered than low self-esteem. Anyway, the next person that shared was my point of identification, and I believe if she hadn't been in that meeting that night, I might not be standing here tonight because of my attitude. She said that she did not drink till later on in life. She said she practiced her disease of alcoholism way before she ever took that first drink, and she did it in the form of compulsive overeating and amphetamine abuse. That's when that old-timer jumped up, cussed her out, and stormed out. But the one thing she said, and this is the real reason why I stayed, she said her whole life growing up, some kids wanted to be doctors, some kids wanted to be lawyers, and all she ever wanted to do when she grew up was just not to be an alcoholic like her mom. And when she said that, I just started to cry, and I couldn't stop. And I cried throughout the rest of the meeting, because that's absolutely the first time in my life that I ever felt like I belonged. And I'm supposed to share with you what it was like, what happened to change me, and what I'm like today. And what happened to change me were the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I always talk about the steps in keeping with the fifth tradition, and I'm trying to condense it a little bit, because the longer you're sober and you add ladybug stories, the longer your talk gets. But I will let you know I did those first 3 steps in a formal manner out of the big book, getting on my knees with my sponsor and saying the third step prayer. I did my inventory according to the big book in those columns. You know, it says to do 3 inventory. It says to do 1 on fear, 1 on resentment, 1 on fear, and 1 on sex. And it tells you to go back and add that 4th column where you look at your part. When I did step 5, I did 5, 6, 7, and 8. all at one time, my sponsor did not trust me to go home and contemplate on my own character defects. She thought it was her job to point them out to me, and it was a good thing she did, because she told me at the very top of my list of character defects, I had self-pity. And I told her in the most pathetic way that I thought my self-pity was justified. Look at my childhood. And she told me in the most loving way, she said, Michael, alcoholics cannot afford justified self-pity. And then she gave me that old cliche, poor me, poor me, pour me another drink. We got on our knees and we said the seventh step prayer, and I can honestly tell you today that self-pity's been totally removed and it's been replaced with overwhelming gratitude. On step 8, we did it in 3 columns. First column was short-term amends that I could do within 6 months. Second column was long-term amends that eventually took me 12 years because I had a lot of wreckage out there. And third column is we worked out ways and means of making restitution to institutions I couldn't get hold of or maybe people who were deceased. And on step 9, my sponsor assured me it did not matter how long it took me to do step 9, as long as I was willing, doing whatever I could. But most importantly, while doing step 9, I still had to live in 10, 11, and 12. I love Chuck C. Chuck C. says this program's about uncovering, discovering, and discarding. And to me, step 9 is the discard step. You know, I know there's a lot of good psychiatrists out there. There's a lot of good psychologists. A lot of them are in 12-step programs, but I have to tell you that that was not my experience. I went to a psychiatrist and a psychologist way before I ever got here. We spent a long time in uncover, discover. Never once got on with discarding, and what that did for me is that allowed me to stay in that victim role for a very long time. And I don't even know how this step works. All I know is in the big book, it tells me I have to disregard the other man's faults entirely. So when I made amends to my real dad, I never once said to him, but you were an older married man, you got my teenage mom pregnant, and you abandoned us. I never once said that to him. I just made amends to him for what I had done. And for some reason, my resentment towards him went away. I don't know how that works, and I don't have to know how it does. I just have to know that it does. On step 10, my sponsor taught me to do a spot check inventory. Immediately, if I know I'm in the wrong, I do 4 through 9 on it. But she believes that, as in a business, all inventories need to be done in writing. So at the end of the evening, before I go to bed, my sponsor has me cast up a balance sheet. And you can read about this balance sheet in step 10, in the 12 and 12, that it falls right in line with steps 10 and 11 in the big book. And on this balance sheet, I list all my assets for the day, and I list all my liabilities for the day. And she said it was important for me to be aware of the things that I'm doing right because I had such low self-esteem. And I get to look at myself in a whole new light. I always have more assets than I do liabilities. On step 11, my sponsor has me do my step 11 in the morning, and it feels comfortable for me. And now that I'm married, my husband and I get on our knees together, and we do the third step prayer, the seventh step prayer. We pray for God to direct our thinking. We pray to be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, self-seeking motives. We pray to know God's will and the power to carry that out. And then on my own, I do a form of meditation where I try to listen to God. And not once in that meditation has God ever come down and told me anything. But as a result of that meditation, I intuitively know how to handle situations throughout the day that used to baffle me. And I've had profound spiritual experiences at totally unexpected times. Now, my sponsor really did stress the 12th step, and she broke it into 3 parts for me. That first part, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of doing those first 11 steps, she said did not necessarily mean a belief in God. She said a lot of us believe in God when we get here. Some people have to come in here and make the 12 steps their higher power or make the group their higher power. She said when you've had that spiritual awakening is where you've actually had that change in psyche, that change in attitude. You've had a huge emotional displacement, rearrangement. You've had a transformation, and it comes from deep within. And when it comes to carrying the message, if I have 15 days of sobriety, I give my phone number to someone who has 7. And she said length of time was not the requirement for sponsorship in this program. The requirement for sponsorship in this program is that you have done your steps, because the real job of a sponsor is to guide you through the steps of the program. Applying these principles in all my affairs, that means I have to practice love and service at work. I have to practice love and service at home. I can't come into this program, walk that walk, talk that talk, and then go out in the world and act like a jerk. And my sponsor knew a lot about Bill W., and she told me right from the start that Bill did not like to use the same word twice, that character defects and shortcomings are the same thing. They're both exact nature of your wrongs in step five that we get from step four. And that principles and steps are the same thing. So if I'm applying these principles in all my affairs, I'm applying these steps in all my affairs. And she said if I was willing to grow along spiritual lines and I stayed current in my steps, eventually someday God would reveal to me when it's time to give up other destructive behavior. The big book says we have to get rid of all those old ideas. She told me it was not okay for me to just not drink but to go ahead and steal. It's not okay for me to just not drink but to prostitute. It's not okay for me to just not drink but to abuse my daughter. And it's not okay for me to just not drink but to binge my brains out and take diet pills. She said if I was working the last part of the 12th step in Alcoholics Anonymous, those things were not okay. But thank God she told me I didn't have to do it all at one time or I surely would have failed, because all those things I just mentioned were listed on my step six, my character defects, and I don't practice any of them today, and I haven't for a very long time. Today I have new character defects. Today I'm judgmental and opinionated, and I don't like that defect, and I consciously work on it because this is my experience. When I get into judgment, I end up walking in their shoes, experiencing their experience to get over the judgment, and that is a heavy price to pay, and I'm not willing to do it today, so I consciously work on that defect. Anyway, so I'm 6 months sober. I'm on my ninth step. My sponsor told me I had to get a job. I had to be fully self-supporting through my own contributions, and I don't know how to work. I went out there and I got that first job, and that's where I learned how to work. I learned things like how to get there every day, how to get there on time, how to not leave early, how to only take a 30-minute lunch break. I did not know how to do those things, and I learned them here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I worked my first job full-time for 8 years. I stayed on another 2 years part-time after I took another full-time position. So I was there for a total of 10 years. And when I left that job, I'd worked myself up to assistant administrator. And in that first 8 year period, I went back to high school. And I graduated from high school in 1985, and I was 36 years old. And I graduated with a cap, a gown, a real ceremony, and 450 18-year-olds. It was truly, truly a humbling experience. What I did for the next 6 years is I went to work for a musical theater corporation, and I was not qualified for this position, but for some reason they were willing to take a chance on me. I had to take a chance on them because it was scary for me to leave my other job. I started out at the bottom in the accounting department, and I went back to school. This is an equity corporation, and equity means it's union, and it deals with big, big major stars. So I started out at the bottom in the accounting department. I went back to school, and within a period of time, I worked myself up to business manager of this multi-million dollar corporation. And as business manager, I dealt with millions of dollars. And when I got to this program, this is the honest to God truth, I didn't even know how many zeros were in $1 million. I have participated in union negotiations. And I have been invited into some of the homes of some of the most famous people you see on stage, screen, and TV. And even today, I'll see myself in a picture with a very famous person, and I just get overwhelmed. I just think, how did I ever get from the gutters of Long Beach to being invited into some of these places? And how that happened is I worked the last part of that 12th step, and I applied these principles in all my affairs. I'm going to share with you two stories, and I'm going to close. And this first story I'm going to share with you because I think it's important to know I had 10 years of sobriety and I almost drank. It was the very first party I went to. It was a birthday as business manager for this corporation. And it was a birthday party for Debbie Reynolds. Nowadays, everyone's so young, they don't have a clue who Debbie Reynolds is. They're not the least bit impressed. But I was very impressed because when I was a little girl, Debbie Reynolds was my very favorite movie star. So I was very impressed. And anyway, the big book says that you'll be placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected, if you're in fit spiritual condition. I was not in fit spiritual condition. In the first place, I hadn't been to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in over 2 weeks because I'm just much too busy growing in the business world. I'm not working with any other alcoholics. The big book says you don't grow spiritually unless you're working with others, but I'm just much too busy growing in the business world. And so I'm at this party, and I got into this thinking, and I started thinking thoughts like, well, maybe now that I have this very impressive job, and I have an education, I drive a brand new car. I'm not that little girl from the other side of the tracks. Maybe I'm really not an alcoholic. And thank God I did not act on it that night, because one healthy thing I've done for myself is I did not have anonymity at work. Everybody at work knew I was sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had enough respect for this program, I didn't want to embarrass it by drinking in front of my coworkers. So I put it off that night. I planned on drinking the next day. And I think anybody who has worked these steps, as hard as I had worked these steps, God had a chance to intervene. Because the next day I was asked to pay a 12-step call on a makeup artist. This man was held up in his motel. He hadn't done a bit of work for 2 weeks. The motel was trying to get him out. So they called my place of employment. My executive director asked me to go see what I could do. And I was very resentful, and I did not want to go. But I called another alcoholic, and we trudged over to the sleazy motel, and I knocked on this man's door. And I identified myself, Michael Alcoholic, and for some reason he answered the door. Now, if that had been me held up, I wouldn't have answered the door. But he answered the door. And I stood there speechless because I did not recognize him. He's a makeup artist. The man I knew had all this blonde, wavy hair. The man standing in front of he was bald-headed. He was 10 times his normal size from bloat. He was profusely sweating. He was bleeding from head to toe because he kept falling into objects. He smelled of urine, he smelled of alcohol, and he smelled of vomit. And at that point, I had a spiritual experience. I had an inner voice talk to me, and it was loud, and it was clear, and it said, Michael, this is you. You are not like the people you were with last night. If you drink again, you are standing in front of a mirror. And that man doesn't know it, but he's the one who paid a 12-step call on me. Because that night, I got my fanny into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I recommitted to this program. I go to more meetings than I've ever gone to. I work with more alcoholics than I've ever worked with, because I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that the longer I'm sober, the more I need meetings. The longer I'm sober, the easier it is for me to forget where I came from. That's what I like about speaking, is I get up here and I constantly remind myself where I came from. This disease is truly cunning, baffling, and powerful. The last story I'm going to share with you is how I came to terms with the God I have in my life today. I told you that my daughter was 15 years old when she got sober. When she was 18 years old, she had 3 years of sobriety. She and her girlfriend were leaving an AA dance. They were in the parking lot of the dance. A man came up to him with a gun, forced these two girls in the car at gunpoint, and he kidnapped them. He knocked the one girl unconscious and brutally raped my daughter for over 2 hours. And I absolutely hate the word rape. Rape sounds like it's just about sex, but rape is really about terror, and it's about violence. And the whole time this was going on, my daughter knew he was going to kill her anyway, and she was so angry at God. It took her over 2 years to remember that she did say a quiet prayer to live. This man was drinking. He had a bottle of alcohol in his pocket that he drank throughout the whole ordeal, thank God, because he got quite drunk. And at the point where he was forcing my daughter into the trunk of the car, somehow my daughter got the courage to at least make some kind of an effort to try to save her own life. She caught him off guard and slugged him in the face as hard as she could. He tripped and he fell down. The gun slid under the wheel and she ran down the street naked. She got away. At that point, he got back into the car and took off with the car, and later on down the street rolled the other girl out into the street, so both girls lived. But the road of recovery was real hard and it was real long. My daughter and I felt absolutely betrayed. How could God let this happen to us? We were both sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. How could God let this happen to us? We were working these steps as hard as we could, and this is a spiritual program. But the hardest thing for me to deal with was a sentence in the big book. It was on page 449, and it talks about acceptance. And I still like the part on acceptance, but that one sentence says absolutely nothing in God's world happens by mistake. Clancy says alcoholism is a disease of perception. I'm still an alcoholic. I still get my disease of perception. And I perceive that to mean that if nothing in God's world happens by mistake, then that had to be an act of God. It had to be an act of God, and I wanted to leave Alcoholics Anonymous, and I wanted to leave God. Because I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt I didn't want any part of God that could operate like that. And thank God for one of those old-timers, Bill Honeycutt, who's now deceased. He just took me by the hand and he said, Michael, God is good and good is God. And if it's not good, it's not of God. He said, man has free will. That man was acting on his free will and your daughter was just a victim. He said, if man didn't have free will, we wouldn't all be sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. We'd all be perfect people. And when he told me that, I had a spiritual release, and I knew he was telling me the truth. I love to hear my sponsor, Polly, share. She always talks about finding God deep within, and that's what it says in the big book. It says we find God deep within. And on that same page, it says it may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things. And when I'm into fear and I'm into calamity, I feel disconnected from my higher power. And that's when I so desperately, desperately need the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because if God's deep within me, then God's deep within you. And it's at these times that God will reach out through another member of this program and pull me back into the sunlight of the Spirit. And that's what happened to me through a man named Bill Honeycutt. So I came to terms with my God again, but I still had so much trouble with that sentence in the big book. I could hear somebody out at registration talk about something wonderful, say that sentence, and I would feel absolute rage. And I sponsor a lot of women in this program, and because I have the story I have, I sponsor women that have suffered terrible tragedies. And maybe this one of these women whose tragedy was worse than my daughter made the mistake of telling me that her tragedy must be God's will, because in the big book it says absolutely nothing in God's world happens by mistake. This woman desperately needed comfort, and I went off on her like a crazy woman. I started screaming at her to the top of my lungs that that wasn't written by the first 100 alcoholics, and it's not in the first 164 pages of the big book. I took the big book, I slammed it down. I said, that's not even in the first two editions of this book. And I made this woman cry. And I knew at that point that I was the one who had a problem. I have a resentment about something in the big book. But this resentment is not only hurting me. Now it's hurting other people. And I came to a place of really being willing to give it up. And I prayed for a very long time for God to help me with that sentence. And about 5 years ago, I was already out traveling and speaking. About 5 years ago, I was with my sponsor, Polly. And she was the speaker in a meeting, and she was sharing about a tape out by Clancy, and it's not even an AA tape. He's addressing a group of doctors. But the name of this tape is Alcoholism, Disease of Perception. And right in that meeting, when she said the words, disease of perception, I had the biggest spiritual encounter that I have ever had. I had that inner voice talk to me one more time, and it wasn't through the ears. And I couldn't hear another word Polly said, and I couldn't see anything else in the room. And that inner voice said, Michael, you know what happens in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous is part of God's world. What happens when you're working those 12 steps is part of God's world. The progression of all good is part of God's world. What happened in that car 9 years ago was part of man's world. And when I was able to separate man's world from God's world, I was able to come to terms with that sentence in the big book. And I can stand up here right now and tell you absolutely nothing in God's world happens by mistake. It's God's world that got me to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So anyway, 2 weeks after I had that spiritual experience through a real weird series of coincidences, I found myself sitting down at a dinner table having dinner with Dr. Paul, who wrote that sentence in the big book. And I was at such peace, I did not have to go off on this man and tell him all about my resentment. Because I knew at that point it didn't matter what he meant when he wrote it. What mattered was how I perceived it. And sometimes I have to work on my perception so that perception can work in my life. And that might not work for you, and that's okay, because I truly believe that God works for each one of us at our own level of understanding. I once heard, if you take one step towards God, God takes 10 steps towards you. And in this lifetime as we know it, we will never ever reach God's level of understanding. But once we're on a spiritual path, God does not want to lose one of us. So he comes to each one of us, and he works for each one of us at our individual level of understanding. And that's why what works for you might not work for me, and what works for me might not work for you. But the beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous is whatever you believe, it will work within the 12 steps. Now, since that day that man's heard my talk, We've had lots of spiritual talks. We've talked at lots of conventions together. In fact, today I consider this man my spiritual advisor. And what he told me about that sentence was he did not mean anything like that when he wrote that sentence. He was not thinking of man's inhumanity to man. He said my spiritual experience was the best explanation he could think of as to why evil exists in this world. And I am so thankful I paid attention to something I read in the 12 and 12 under step 10. It said restraint of pen and tongue. Because when I found out this man was alive, I used to think everybody in the big book was dead. When I found out this man was still alive, I cannot tell you how many countless times I sat down and I started to write him a hate letter and tell him exactly what I thought about him and exactly what I thought about that sentence. And if I followed through on that, I would have missed out on this gift, because today this man is a gift in my life, and he gets lots of letters about that sentence. He gets lots of phone calls about that sentence. And what he does a lot of the time today is he just gives them my phone number. I want to thank you for allowing me to be here. I know today I've been catapulted into what Bill calls that fourth dimension of existence. And he talks about it 2 times in the big book, maybe more. But, you know, I sound like I know everything about the big book. And I am a big book thumper, but I only know the things that were important to me and impacted me. So there's lots of things I don't know about the big book. I just want to make that clear. But he talks about that fourth dimension on 2 pages. And on page 25, he talks about being rocketed into that fourth dimension. But I really like page 8 because he says catapulted. And on that page, he gives a description of that fourth dimension. Today, I know happiness and peace. But best of all, absolutely best of all today, I know usefulness. Thank you.